Welcome to Environmentality, your source for environmental news, lectures, and interviews with the experts. I'm your host, Dr. Brendan Anthony. Let's dive on in. All right, welcome to the show, everyone. Today, I have a dear friend on. Her name is Sarah Whipple, and she is a PhD candidate at the ecology program here at Colorado State and also works for the National Park Service. And today she's going to be talking to us about the wonderful world of pollinators. So thank you so much for joining me, Sarah.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to chatting.
Yeah, you bet. So how about you just go ahead and give me and our listeners a little bit of your background and how you got interested in the environment and in ecology and more specifically pollinators.
Yeah, my history and background with pollinators honestly kind of fell into my lap. My passion for ecology began on a first field experience that I was able to take way back in high school, which feels so long ago at this point. I took a college course at College of the Atlantic, which is this really small college in Bar Harbor, Maine, and it's only human ecology that they focus on there. There's about 300 students that attend that college total, so very tiny, but did a summer field class with them. And we spent 45 days in a canoe doing field work along the Allegash River, which is a river that extends from Maine to Canada. So we canoed the whole river. And it was my first time canoeing, being that remote and away from family. We were catching frogs along the river and kind of monitoring the health of these frogs and other, you know, small invertebrates and toads and things like that. But I loved every minute of it. And that led me to Colorado State University, where I did my undergraduate career in the Ecosystem Science and Sustainability Department here. I got a bachelor's degree in that back in 2018. And through that department and the connections that CSU has, fell into some research opportunities with Dr. Gillian Bowser, who is my advisor, tailored towards National Park Service work and also pollination ecology. And way back in the early years of my undergraduate career, I was invited to go participate in the National Park Service BioBlitz events, which at the time were some outreach and biodiversity projects that the parks were running. BioBlitzes are 24-hour rapid inventories to look at species diversity. And my first participation in the BioBlitzes was in 2015 in Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. So being able to go catch insects for the first time in a beautiful location such as Hawaii Volcanoes was kind of a transformative experience and has really led me to honestly where I'm at now. But no prior background to pollinators until that opportunity. And then it's been a lot of kind of self-taught as well as, you know, having amazing mentors here at CSU to guide me through, you know, all the science behind this really important topic.
Yeah, for sure. Something I've always been curious about, and you mentioned frogs and toads. What is the difference between a frog and a toad?
So frogs and toads, and oh man, that was at this point probably like 12 years ago. So it's been a while. So someone may comment in your podcast saying she's totally wrong. I think frogs and toads have differences in like where they lay their eggs. So toads can be more land dwelling and can lay eggs, I think, on ground. Whereas frogs, you know, they'll lay tadpole eggs and are more aquatic in nature. I think habitat too can really make a difference, like where you can find frogs versus toads. So when we were searching for frogs, it would be a lot more aquatic sampling, whereas toads would be in kind of like the mud and the gross kind of habitats around or right next to some of the river itself. So that would be my interpretation of the difference between a frog and a toad, but they're not pollinators.
Exactly. Well, you know, I'm just kind of curious, you know, obviously I think every kid kind of grows up, you know, sifting through the muck and catching toads. And I'm wondering, you know, you mentioned this, you know, amazing experience in high school. Were you always outside even as a kid too, you know, interacting with animals? Like, was this love for nature and animals and invertebrates stemmed even like in your childhood?
Yeah, it's a great question. And ironically enough, it wasn't. My first time actually visiting a national park was Acadia National Park, which is the neighboring park of College of the Atlantic in Maine. It's a beautiful park, one of my favorite parks.
I've always wanted to go.
Yeah. But I actually was raised by a family that's mostly doctors and don't have, you know, they've always seen the benefit of the outdoors, but never had that innate connection to nature and things like that. And so it was not necessarily, I think, my upbringing that really inspired me to be in this path that I'm in now. My parents are, and other family are very supportive of this, but I think really those transformative experiences I had, such as that first field experience, and then being able to really hands-on work on some Park Service projects early on in my science career, is what led me to this path. And it's not to say like my parents kept us inside or anything like that. Like, we did spend a lot of time outside, but especially that connection to national parks and some of these protected areas, didn't see a ton of that growing up. And so it's been really eye-opening to experience that now, like later on in my life.
Yeah, those experiences definitely helped you catch the bug. So bad. No, you know, it's very similar to my experience as well, where, you know, I grew up in, you know, Orange County, very urban, you know, no experience to agriculture whatsoever. My parents were both academics. So, you know, again, we were outside and all that, but was never really engaged with agriculture more than the sense of, oh, there's avocados growing behind our houses. And I, through a high school class in horticulture, you know, became very excited about plants as well. And then, you know, started taking more classes in college and had more, you know, really pivotal experiences for me up in Washington. So I totally relate with that. And I always feel like experiential learning is always like the best way to captivate, you know, passions for people. And I think it's cool to see your trajectory go from like the furthest northeast part of the country and like Maine and Canada border all the way to like the furthest southwest to Hawaii. And you've seen like this huge path of, you know, finding, you know, cool different ecology and ecosystems and kind of captivating yourself in this field. I'm curious more about this experience in Hawaii. You know, so you mentioned this bio blitz where you're going out and doing surveys. Was this primarily for you to observe and understand the biodiversity specifically with pollinators in the national park?
Yeah. So the bio blitzes themselves, they didn't have any taxa targets for them. So the goal of the BioBlitzes was to just inventory as many species as possible within a 24-hour time period. And this had, you know, a lot of successes, but also many failures. And, you know, within the Hawaii Volcanoes BioBlitz, we actually had terrible weather the few days that they were wanting to run these inventories. Lots of rain, you know, very, very much like a sucked in tropical environment climate, right? And as a result, diversity outcomes from that event were, in all honesty, really low for a tropical ecosystem. You know, that broader context as to why is what generates that data. But if you're just looking at that event writ large, you'd be like, nothing actually happened here. Like, no species were really found. And this is like kind of concerning and alarming. And that's, you know, where I think that ecological thought is really important to keep in mind. But when I visited and was participating in the Hawaii Volcanoes BioBlitz and participated in one in 2016 in celebration of the National Park Service centennial, which the BioBlitzes were a 10-year event that led up to the 100th year of the National Park Service as a system, they brought in what they considered like subject matter experts to help with the taxonomy, species collection, identification for each of these parks. So Gillian and myself were brought in as some insect taxonomists to help with the Hawaii Volcanoes and other BioBlitz events. But there were lots of other researchers, you know, university academics from the surrounding area that participate as well. The BioBlitz is really heavy, has a heavy focus on citizen science engagement within the parks. So bringing non-experts in to participate in scientific discovery and understanding. And the BioBlitz has also had lots of cultural significance, especially for a park like Hawaii Volcanoes that has some more of the traditional indigenous knowledge incorporated into the management of that park as a whole. So yeah, sure. That's a heavy emphasis in those types of events. So a little bit science, but also a little bit interpretation, which is a lot of the National Park Service units. So yes, you know, brought in to help with that, but it's a bigger event than just looking at pollinators as a whole. Cool. And they aren't, unfortunately, running BioBlitzes these days, unless it's a park-specific initiative, because it's just too complex, too big of a project to feasibly manage on a national level.
Yeah, yeah. You're casting a wide net trying to capture a high level of biodiversity in these spaces. I know you've worked in also the Grand Tetons and Yellowstone. You know, were you doing similar type of work in these parks as well?
Yeah, so in Grand Teton and Yellowstone National Parks, that's where my dissertation research has occurred. And it's been a much deeper dive into species occurrence, pollinator ecology. My advisor actually studied butterflies pre-Yellowstone 1988 fire, which is considered the largest known fire to the area. And so we have that historical snapshot of the status of butterflies, which are only one group of pollinators, to kind of work off of. So my dissertation research in those parks is comparing some of that historical context to what we're seeing in the parks today, looking at trends such as shifting phenology or species emergence that then could be cueing other changes to that ecosystem as a whole, such as changes in temperature and precipitation or snowpack, and making projections about what the status of those species are going to look like in, you know, 50, 100 years based on the current climate phenological projections that we have. So it's taking much more of that ecosystem-based approach to pollinators just as a whole. It doesn't have a very straightforward taxonomic scope to it. You know, we're looking at all types of pollinators, not just butterflies, not just bees. So in that sense, it has some application to other Park Service initiatives like the BioBlitzes and other inventory projects that the Park Service has utilized. But at the same time, it's also applying some of that ecological change and, you know, broader context of the ecosystem itself, even though it is a protected area and nevertheless will impact climate change as we now see it. So I think that's, you know, for me, been a great application of some of the initial interest and translating it into some bigger questions of concern that we're currently all facing.
So maybe if we want to just take a step back real quick, and if you want to maybe just define what a pollinator is and what they could be, and then what is the significance of pollinators?
So pollinators are species that facilitate the pollination of floral resources. So they transfer pollen, which are considered the male gametes, from flower to flower. And this helps in successful plant reproduction and growth. Pollinators don't have to just be insects. So my research is specifically looking at insects, and these can include species like bees, butterflies, moths, flies, beetles, and more. You know, ants can do some pollination to an extent. But pollinators can also include species like birds, bats, and even small animals. Even big animals, you know, you could have a bison helping with pollination depending on the floral density and where they're moving, I guess.
Yeah. And humans too. Yeah.
And humans can act as pollinators as well as, you know, natural forces like wind can act as pollinators. But insect pollinators are really critical to study because they're in some sense considered the most efficient mechanism for pollination. And a lot of floral resources have mutualistically evolved with insect pollinators to have the most efficient, viable reproduction capabilities in the event of those two species coexisting. So, you know, that's why I think there's so much talk of like saving the bees and saving butterflies. You know, you see a lot of press these days advocating for saving the monarchs and looking out for even the plant species like milkweed or other floral resources that pollinators are really dependent on. But the reality is, you know, we're really dependent on the pollinators themselves because they help regulate and sustain our food and agricultural resources in ways that in the event of those species dying off, we'll have to do a lot of groundwork to perhaps maintain. So that's really why insect pollinators, I think, get so much attention is due to that efficiency and the relationships that have historically and naturally occurred. And, you know, I think as more and more data becomes available about the status of managed but also wild pollinator species, you know, more and more attention will be devoted to protecting those species in the future.
You know, you kind of touched on this already. You know, I think the interdependency of our food system, and in particular, you know, honeybees that are doing a lot of the pollination to facilitate a lot of these fruit and nut crops, you know, and their production for us to consume, you know, but I feel like it's such a narrow focus at times where, you know, it's just primarily one species, if I'm not mistaken, you know, and, you know, one sector of, you know, life, which is agriculture. You know, you're obviously working on a little bit of a different context, working with other types of insects, other types of industries, being, you know, conservation and land protection, et cetera. I'm curious, like, what would be the significance of your field and the idea of conserving public lands and conserving pollen, like native pollinators in these areas, for someone who's maybe only looking at this issue from like a utilitarian perspective of only focusing on bees and agriculture?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's one that we're still really trying to unravel, because the reality is there's not a ton of data supporting the need for conservation or even the background of the status of wild pollinators. So that's really where all of my work in the national parks has been nothing but discovery, because many parks just have no prior knowledge of pollinator species occurring in their park. But the importance of, you know, those protected or conserved lands from a broader scale is only going to act as an indicator of the status of those managed ecosystems just adjacent to or external to a protected area. And, you know, a lot of pollinator species like bees, like butterflies, can travel much further than we as humans can perceive. So, you know, having some of those protected areas and native ecosystems that they can even utilize for pollination services on top of agricultural services that are maybe more monoculture based and not as viable from, you know, their floral resource needs, can only strengthen that relationship between those managed and wild ecosystems. And unfortunately, you know, that's not enough of a justification yet, I think, for a lot of people to see the benefit of protected areas, because we don't have enough data yet to really justify those claims. But the more that we can study these ecosystems, study those relationships, and highlight the need for both those wild ecosystems where native, you know, previous relationships of floral resources and pollinators occurred, compared to some of those managed ecosystems just external to a park, you know, I think the stronger that crop system will also become. So,
yeah,
you know, it's a little bit selfish in nature to think about it in that sense. But yeah. I think the benefit is twofold, because
sure,
we'll have better crops, but we also have these protected areas that we can find enjoyment in and beauty in as well.
Yeah, you need more than just food, right? You need recreation. And I think you articulated that so well, that the health of protected areas certainly impacts the health of managed areas just external to that. And I think a great example of that was, you know, the example of a keystone species in Yellowstone, which were the wolves, and how the reintroduction of wolves, you see this like trophic cascade of impacts that once you introduce the species back in, you totally rehabilitate the landscape, this area, you know. And you mentioned this word indicator, and I wonder if maybe you want to maybe further elaborate on what is an indicator species. I think a lot of people understand what a keystone species is in an ecosystem, but what is the significance of an indicator species in an ecosystem or in a protected area like Yellowstone?
So indicator species are organisms, and it can be any type of species, that can measure or track an environmental condition. There's a lot of connectivity to keystone species and indicator species. I would argue that wolves even could act as an indicator species for Yellowstone National Park, but they are also a keystone species. And so an indicator species, if they're abundant in an area, this means that the environment is stable or it's doing well. You know, you're thinking of a really intact ecosystem or anything like that. But if that species is scarce, then this means that the environment is unstable or not doing well. And, you know, the indicator species are important because they help us better understand ecosystem integrity or how well an area or habitat is doing. When it comes to, you know, pollinators, there's really not enough data to say if any one species acting as an indicator of environmental quality, but hopefully this can change over time. You know, it's hard for the public to relate to temperature warming and that perhaps being the need or justification to protect an area. It's much easier if you can have a poster child species saying, this species not doing well, you know, especially if it's like something charismatic, like a bumblebee, or, I mean, we don't have pandas in the US, but like a bear of some sort, you know, something that folks want to protect. And if they see that need and connection of, oh, bears in Yellowstone are not doing well because temperature is warming and that's causing larger scale problems to the environment that they live in, then that can act as a justification for conservation efforts. So, you know, I think for our small species like the pollinators, we don't have that data to support, you know, this is the need or why an environment is changing or not doing well. But I think the more data and background we can get, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we'll see that happening more and more. And I mean, you see it already in managed systems, right? Where if there's not pollinators present, then that agricultural system is not going to do well.
So in respect to like some of the charismatic indicator species you're kind of mentioning as kind of creating this like platform for a marketing strategy, so to speak, I think a good example of that is like the polar bears in the Arctic. And so I think, yeah, if you're able to kind of ascertain a pollinator, you know, to these types of issues, I think that would certainly help, you know, the cause and the types of strategies you guys are trying to employ. And just to speak to the agriculture side, yeah, we definitely see that happening where, you know, honey is a sheer byproduct of pollination services. You know, I think so often people think, oh, like, you know, beekeeping is this beautiful art, but it's really a small cottage industry. Like, by and large, managed bees are being used not for honey production, but for pollination. And they're shipped crazy distances, typically from the Southeast all the way to California, where they're primarily being used in almond orchards, you know, to get us all the nuts and the almond milks that we enjoy. And, you know, then you start to think about, and you've seen a lot of this in the press recently about, you know, colony collapse disorder and the fatigue and the viruses that they're being plagued with, as well as the pesticides and the impacts of neonicotinoids and the impacts that they're having on their health. And so you see a tremendous cascading impact of when you start to lose the functionality and health of some of these species, then it trickles down into the economics and the productivity of these agricultural systems, which certainly will affect everybody. So yeah, it's a huge issue. And I'm curious if maybe you have any sort of indication of a nice charismatic pollinator that you're seeing in, you know, these parks. Are you noticing anything interesting, you know, in the phenotypic changes over the past 40 years? Maybe if you want to share a little bit of some of the results and things you're seeing from your data, if you're willing to share.
Yeah. And I guess just to comment before I, you know, transition into some work in the protected areas, you know,
yeah,
this isn't to say that the managed ecosystems and all the agricultural benefits that honeybees or other managed species provide, this isn't to like discredit all of that work. You know, I think when done well, you know, that can be a sustainable process that only facilitates food production and, you know, the bees get good food resources themselves. I don't think, you know, the transportation and stress that some of those now managed systems have put on honeybee production are well and good. And there's, you know, a lot of data coming out that the competition for those floral resources, even if it's, you know, in a managed or just adjacent conserved area with wild pollinators or those non-managed species, is honestly pretty high. So even though we're super reliant on honeybees now, and we're starting to see some of these implications and effects of, you know, kind of overusing that resource, to our own advantage. I think there's going to be a lot more cascading effects happening, you know, in the next 5-10 years when we're thinking more about these wild pollinators in relationship to that system as well. So, you know, I think it's kind of a misconception that folks have. And like you said, you know, it's purely economic based, and we get a lot of benefits from honeybees. You can't really get honey from, honestly, any wild species either. So, you know, I get why we've kind of manipulated this process as a whole, but I think there are some challenges that folks don't necessarily realize, and we're going to have to grapple in the next 5 to 10 years, unless something changes.
Well, and then just, I guess, before we go into that, you know, I think it's interesting that you mentioned this idea of floral competition. Mm-hmm. So are you suggesting that because we bring in honeybees to these orchards, they're taking all those floral resources, that the native populations are then being, I guess, kind of like forced out or and put into more direct competition for those, and so then that's having a negative impact on the native populations?
Yeah, that's the thought, especially with some of those, you know, massive orchards that you see, like especially in California, and, you know, where bees are shipped in for, you know, a few weeks, a month, of however long that growing season is. You know, if almond flowers are your only resource for miles upon miles, yes, wild bees can travel, but not, they're not going to travel more than they realistically need to, because that's a stressor to their system as well. So that leads to competition of, if that's your primary resource within an area and it's now being overrun with species that were introduced to the area to facilitate in that pollination process, you know, that leads to just not enough food available for all the pollinators in that system. And then when, you know, those honeybees move on to another orchard or another place, you know, they're moved on for a reason, because most of those floral resources have been utilized, pollinated, and there's not going to be a ton of pollen or nectar available left for those native species to use themselves. So
it's super fascinating. It makes sense. I think, you know, maybe just provide some context as to, you know, why native pollinators aren't being used for these agricultural systems. Is that primarily because honeybees are just the most efficient, the fastest, the hardest working, because they produce the honey? You know, why aren't we able to then rely on native pollinators to do this work for us?
It's a great question. And I won't be surprised if in the next few years, more people are trying to domesticate some of the wild pollinators, especially the more efficient ones like squash bees or mason bees. This kind of goes into some biology related information, like context. So let me know if I go too much into the weeds.
Let's go for it. Let's dive in.
But the European honeybee is the managed bee that we utilize in the US. And it's the managed bee that most places in the world utilize. But there are a few other honeybee species that are seen throughout the world that are also used for food production. The reason we haven't introduced those to the U.S. Really comes down to, we don't have the right climate for them to sustain themselves. So some of these other honeybee species rely on a much more tropical climate to stay alive. And we clearly don't have that with our growing seasons in most of these areas. Honeybees are also very easy to reproduce. And, you know, even though the transportation is a big stress for them, they are easy to transport. And this is going into the dynamic of honeybees as a whole. And this concept's called eusocialism, which means that honeybees as colonies support themselves and sustain themselves. And the honeybees that live in a colony are doing everything in their part that they can to support the health and longevity of the queen of that colony. And the queen acts as the sole reproducer and creates hundreds of thousands of worker bees and drones that then can bring in resources and protect the hive and so forth. But not all bee species have this eusocialistic dynamic where they are protecting their hive for the greater good of their hive. So you have some that are considered non-social or solitary bees. You might have heard that language in literature and things like that. And these types of bees, solitary bees, can also help with food production and pollination. You know, they are great pollinators themselves, but they're much harder for us to manage as humans and domesticate because they're very self-interested. And so if you put them all into one colony, chances are they're going to just like fight with each other and then kill each other. And you know, that's not good for the bees. That's not good for you as the caretaker of those species. And those are just, you know, a few reasons as to why honeybees have become, you know, so overrun within the agricultural system. And yeah, I mean, it's fascinating that it really comes down to their evolutionary change and division from some of these other bee species that don't have those same behaviors. There are wild species that are considered eusocialistic. A lot of bumblebees species do have eusocialistic tendencies, but not all bumblebees. And those discrepancies between species is, to me, really fascinating, but we don't have enough data to really understand why some are more solitary than others, some are eusocialistic, and so forth. But I think there's more coming out about, you know, the benefit of starting to manage some of these other colonies. I know that there's been some attempts and some successes with domesticating bumblebee species because they are great at, it's called buzz pollination, where they can really like shake a flower. A good example of a food resources that we use that requires buzz pollination is blueberries, as an example, or cranberries. So bumblebees are going to be that dominant pollinator for those types of resources. But some of those solitary bees are going to be better pollinators of species like squash or tomatoes because of the location of their floral resources that are just much harder for a honeybee or a big bee like a bumblebee to access. So, you know, I think if we're thinking about food security and all of the food resources that we use, not all of the foods that we rely on are going to be able to succeed with just honeybees. So thinking about some of these other species, even if it is challenging to domesticate or manage, is going to be essential because otherwise we won't have that food diversity that we all currently rely on. And that's not necessarily a bad thing if our food systems become less diverse in nature, given perhaps a greater reliance on native species in an area or anything like that. I guess I'm a firm believer of shopping local, eating local, and things like that. And if that means not having as much managed, you know, pollination coming in, great. But we still have a long ways to go with that kind of mindset happening within our society.
Yeah, it's super interesting. I guess it makes sense, similar to like an investment portfolio. You know, you need to diversify your investments. We need to diversify the pollinators we're using. And some pollinators, as you're suggesting, might be better fit for particular crops based on, you know, the floral phenology and the architecture of certain canopies and plants. So I think that's super fascinating. I know there's been some research done in Utah State looking at blue orchard bees. Are you familiar with blue orchard bees, or I think they call them bobs?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, not enough to like say anything poetic about them, but I'm a little bit a little bit familiar with the text.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. So it's super interesting. I think it's already starting to happen. That was done in, I think, tart cherry systems down in Utah. And so you're starting to see, I think, diversity of these honeybees or other types of bees come in and pollinators to help with this issue, as we've talked about colony collapse disorder and the overexertion of some of these species. I think to further down this agricultural road, and then we can jump back to your research. You know, if, for example, we have massive colony collapse disorder, we have the death of honeybees, you know, I think so often the solution for humans is to add technology to it. Add technology to the problem, we can solve any issue. And I think what some of the stuff we're seeing now is this idea of artificial pollination and mechanical pollination. And I was working for a master's up in Washington State, where some of the professors were working on this as a viable tool to kind of no longer need to depend on bees, because not only are they being overworked and there's issues with that, they're actually a lot harder to get because there's such a limited population. So for growers who can't get bees, and they need them during their bloom window, this might be a viable technology or option for them. And what this looks like, it's pollen being suspended in an electrostatic system because the stigma of the flower is actually, I believe, a positive charge. And so you have to electrostatically charge the pollen grain with a negative charge in order for it to help and adhere to the flower for pollination, which is what the bees and pollinators do naturally. They carry this charge differential, but because without the insect, you have to do this, you know, mechanically in order to make this be effective. And so we're starting to see this, I think, start to be developed. I think it's a long way from being industrially applied throughout, you know, several orchards and industries. But I'm curious on your perspective on this idea of no longer needing to rely on biology, but instead let's just add technology to the solution. And from your perspective as, you know, a pollinator biologist, like, what are your thoughts and feelings on this?
Yeah, it's tricky. I see the utility of it, and, you know, especially with that, you know, that comment of the supply and the demand of some of these resources, like the shipment of bees around and things like that, that complexifies this question even more, because if you had, in an ideal world, you know, native species that could come in and help with that pollination rather than this reliance on either a managed species or the technology itself, you know, I think it's just tough. It's tough for farmers because they want to have the crops available so they can pay the bills themselves. And unfortunately, I think with species in decline, due to all these varying circumstances, you know, you mentioned pesticide use and neonicotinoids, disease, viruses, you know, climate change, urbanization, habitat fragmentation, all of these concerns, you know, I think these technologies will become more common and honestly more effective to run such large-scale agricultural systems that we rely on. Do I agree with this? Like, from the native natural system? Not entirely, because I think, you know, us humans, we don't see that bigger picture of, like, we're contributing to a problem. You know, we're outrunning our ecosystems and the services and functions that we've just become way too dependent on. So we don't really understand the repercussions of that impact long term. And, you know, further out, the sustainability of that type of resource may not be viable. You know, it might end up that the plants themselves become resistant or evolve over time, because that's not traditionally how that ecosystem service worked. You know, there were these mutualistic relationships between pollinators and flowers to persist. But, you know, it brings some social equity concerns of, like, we need to fight food insecurity. We need to maintain sustainable yields to reflect our growing population. And if there are ways to facilitate this process and to continue to do the research and monitor the effects of this on a broader ecosystem function, you know, then I think that evolution will need to occur. But I think it's just like, it's like us trying to put our own hands into God's work, right? And these systems, plants and species, have relied on each other and coexisted for so long. And for us to just change them and manipulate these systems for economic benefit, that's tough, you know, and you see the pros and cons to both, but we just don't have enough background to know what that long-term implication will be like until we become dependent on it and we're having to kind of realize how that has changed over time.
It's the constant struggle, I think, with any topic in sustainability where you have to satisfy, you know, environmental challenges, economic needs, social demands, and trying to ameliorate all these problems and try to find a holistic solution that benefits all. And it's really challenging. And I think that's why it's important to have people from all sectors, collaborating interdisciplinary science to try and find good solutions. And I appreciate your balanced perspective on, you know, the necessity of some of these issues. I think at times the criticism for, you know, artificial pollination is this idea of, well, instead of investing all this money into a technology, why don't we invest this money into the conservation of the species? And, you know, sometimes it's hard to balance, like, well, what's the shorter term or a longer term benefit of each of these routes? And, you know, you have to do the cost benefit analysis to figure that out, or you have people working on both sides, which is good too. So anyways, just kind of curious on that perspective. And I think we've sufficiently gone down the agricultural route. I want to just jump back as we kind of wrap up into your research in protected lands and maybe just some of the highlights that you're seeing so far in your studies. It sounds like you are capturing, you know, 40 years of change more or less in the park. Obviously the climate is changing. Many things have changed. You know, what are maybe some of the highlights that you're seeing based on your inventories and investigations into the biodiversity and phenotypical changes of these pollinators in these parks?
So I'll start with the bad, but then I'll end on some good.
Okay, good.
And the bad is since, you know, pre-88 fires, which had huge ecosystem changes to, you know, that was a tipping point for the greater Yellowstone ecosystem as a whole, which includes Yellowstone and Teton National Parks, but also, you know, some of the cities and urban areas, urban for that part of Wyoming and Montana, urban areas, you know, adjacent Forest Service, BLM lands, all of these areas. It was, you know, a real tipping point for that ecosystem. But since that time, you know, compared to what we're seeing over the past few years, shifts in phenology have been dauntingly over a month and a half early. So when bees and butterflies were starting to emerge in the Yellowstone Teton area, you know, after the 4th of July holiday, we're now starting to see some of those species emerging around Memorial Day, which is late May. And that change in species emergence and floral emergence over time hasn't, you know, that's a pretty quick change in how little time there's been between then and now. And what's causing that change is unclear. You know, is it the change in temperature? Is it the change in snowpack? You know, we believe that it's perhaps a lot of factors, you know, impacting that. But one of the biggest things that we've seen since 88 fire is a dramatic decline in that snowpack availability, precipitation, that then is encouraging floral emergence to be earlier and earlier each season. And as a result, the subsequent pollinators that rely on those plants to also emerge earlier and earlier. And that has concerns of mismatch between the flowers that are emerging earlier and earlier, and perhaps the pollinators themselves not queuing early enough to respond to that change. And, you know, we're starting to see more climate anomalies happening in those parks as well, such as more frequency of natural disasters like fires, but also weird freak events. Like in 2019, on the first day of summer, we got 2 feet of snow in that area. And if there's floral resources that have already emerged, you know, that's going to pretty much end their growing season. If they're covered in snow, they're freezing and they can't, you know, sustainably come back or bounce back from that event. So that's going to have larger implications on the pollinators as well. You know, have to do some more modeling to really see the impact of that change and make projections as to what that will look like 10, 20, 15 years. But from that recent time scale compared to, you know, what we were seeing 30 or so years ago, you know, there has been a dramatic shift in the emergence and phenological cues that are happening within the park, all tied to changes in climate. On the plus side, you know, we're seeing remarkable species diversity within these parks and the persistence of species diversity. One of kind of the biggest poster childs of the West, not only within our protected areas, but, you know, in areas all over the West, urban areas, you know, Fort Collins, anywhere like that, there is a bumblebee species that is proposed to be listed as endangered called the Western bumblebee, Bombus occidentalis. It's a pretty prominent looking species, There's not a ton of species that look like it. And the cause of decline is thought to be solely habitat shifts happening in the West and much more urbanization, habitat degradation happening over time because of population booms within the West. However, within the Yellowstone and Teton area, we've consistently been seeing presence of occidentalis year after year and healthy presence of occidentalis, not just once in a blue moon we're collecting an occidentalis. In its peak emergence time, we're seeing, you know, a good amount of occidentalis, and good amount is very subjective, right? But for a species that is proposed to be listed, you know, that's a remarkable feat. And so I think that really highlights the importance of these protected areas and conserving spaces. Is we can support the species even that we think are at a really high risk of extinction or decline solely by keeping these areas protected. And, you know, the greater Yellowstone ecosystem with growing towns like Bozeman, that's honestly grown too fast for its own good, or even Jackson, you know, which is always remained about the same, but, you know, they're developed areas right next to these parks, you know, keeping those urban areas away from those parks so that those habitats really can be conserved, I think is going to be the biggest need that we'll have, you know, over the next 10, 20, 50 years to protect all of the species, not just occidentalis or other pollinator species, but, you know, the wolves, the bears, the bison that these parks are truly known for and were part of, you know, the founding reasons as to why these parks were conserved in the first place.
Just to go back to the negative, and you're talking about, you know, things emerging sooner and earlier, could that potentially be a benefit in the sense that you have maybe a little bit longer growing season? You can maybe have more diversity of plant production or longer plant production, which can then support more food resources. Like, is there a benefit to having that? Or are you seeing them like earlier fall frost events, and so the growing season stays the same?
Yeah, it's a good question. I wouldn't say it's neither bad nor good. I guess the only time that it becomes bad is we're not having as much fall frost or early fall frost that's like snapping the growing season. The problem is it's just getting too hot in that area. So plants will just die because they don't have enough moisture to maintain themselves. So, gotcha. You know, I've been doing field work now in Yellowstone Teton by the end of the dissertation, it'll probably be 8 years, which is kind of wild to think about. But, yeah, you know, in my first field season, we wouldn't hit temperatures above 80 degrees Fahrenheit, which, you know, is pleasant. And I think most plants, that's like a good, you know, stasis for them of they can maintain themselves and so forth. But now, you know, especially this past field season in 2020, where we had massive wildfires across the West, you're dealing with the pollutants of smoke that are perhaps impacting floral resources. The pollinators certainly don't like smoke, but also, you know, 100 plus temperatures in parks like Yellowstone and Teton, which is unheard of, on top of drought and other kind of longer term problems that are just stacking on top of themselves that just doesn't allow for the floral resources to survive, you know, in an entire summer season like they usually would be able to. So that's why, you know, having variations in phenology across species is important too. You know, not all pollinators will emerge right at the start of spring or right at the start of summer. And we see that in floral resources and food resources we rely on. You know, they don't all have the same growing season, but if these cues of when to emerge shift more and more and more species are emerging at the same time, or they're not emerging in conjunction with that pollinator species, then, you know, that's a bigger issue to deal with.
Yeah, it becomes a huge issue. And I know it especially becomes a big issue for species that are migratory in nature, like birds, especially, you know, where, you know, they are dependent to go to this area at a particular time, but, you know, maybe that, you know, flower or that food source is now gone or it's not yet arrived. And so, yeah, that disruption on some of those patterns I know can be really damaging. I guess just in conclusion, if you want to speak to, you know, how can people be involved? How can people contribute to the conservation of pollinators or be more interested, whether on the agricultural side or on the public land side? You know, how can people who are listening get involved in this work?
So I'll start with like what you can do at home, and then I guess I'll extend out to like what you can do in your national parks. Cool. So from a local side, you know, when you say stuff like save the bees, don't take it into the consideration of just saving the honeybees or saving the monarchs. You know, there's so many other species that we need to be considering. And ways that you can help with that is planting native plants within your garden, native flowers that other pollinator species will be attracted to, and diversifying your own landscape so it's not as monoculture dependent or honeybee dependent, anything like that. And thinking about what other benefits those native species can bring even to your own backyard. From a national park perspective, and we didn't touch on this a ton other than with the BioBlitz efforts, you know, there's lots of citizen science opportunities within our protected lands and within your own backyard too. So if you have that passion and curiosity for what you're seeing in your backyard or in a protected landscape, you have, you know, simply the phone that you have probably in your back pocket and are able to take a photo of that species to document it, that's contributing to this greater scientific question of providing background knowledge that perhaps is not currently there. And so getting involved in citizen science efforts to help with that data understanding, other conservation efforts like helping to plant native species within your local park or area. The national parks aren't doing a ton of planting efforts unless it's for a restoration purpose, but now they're having a lot more intentions of how can our species restoration benefit pollinator species. And that's something I'm doing with the national parks right now is helping them gain that context. But those are just a few ways that you can kind of contribute to this greater question of, you know, what is the status of pollinators and how can we better protect them is, you know, simply diving into some of those questions yourself, learning more and educating more people about the importance of all those native species.
And the benefit is that those two endeavors are really fun. I know I love gardening at my house, and I also love going to national parks. So it sounds like there's a lot of really fun opportunities to play a part in this. How can people follow you? Do you have like a science Twitter or an Instagram? You know, how if people want to follow your journey through academia, through this research, how can they check you out?
So I am on Twitter. My handle is SarahWhipple15. And I would say that's definitely more of my academic space. I do a lot of work in policy too, but also find it funny to relate with other graduate students on that platform. So if you're kind of curious about pollinators, but also other graduate related questions or climate change policy questions, that's definitely one way to reach out. I'm trying to get into the TikTok space with my pollinator videos, because I do a lot of macro photography and videography when I'm in some of these national parks. And my handle on that is NPS Bug Girl, BUGGIRL. But I need to like get more followers, because I think I've been like shadowed out or whatever they call it in TikTok. So come hang out with me on that platform. Maybe I'm too old for it, but it's been kind of fun to showcase, you know, a lot of that videography and photography that we've been able to do.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, even the photo behind you, if you all can see, it's a beautiful macro shot of a bee pollinating. So I love it. I'll make sure to drop those handles in the show notes.
Cool. Thanks
for having
me. Well,
thanks so much, Sarah. I learned so much, and on just the benefits of pollinators, the, you know, justification for them as an indicator species and understanding their role in understanding and also preserving the ecological system's health and all the many, many environmental and ecosystem services that they provide. So very grateful for your knowledge and providing your wisdom and your research on the topic.
And thanks for providing the agricultural background that I clearly lack.
No, you know plenty. It was amazing. I appreciate you indulging me to go down that path a bit.
Yeah. I mean, it's equally, if not more important for us to be thinking about from that sustainability aspect. So it's a pleasure to work in the national parks, but all systems are just as important for protecting our pollinators.
For sure. For sure. Well, it's good. It's good to have that holistic approach and to understand things from all systems. So appreciate it.
Thanks.